Morning and happy spring. Let me take a second here to get settled. You know, when Ed called me up on the phone about a week ago or so, told me, this is his idea, by the way, that I kind of thought, I said, well, what value could my testimony have to people sitting in an audience? It's not an easy thing to do, get up here and stand in front of people and give your testimony. Reason being is because where I came from, being the secular world, you really are inconsequential. And when you're before you're saved, you don't think that way. And I thought that the world revolved around me, and that nothing else mattered except what I wanted or what could satisfy me. But once you become or have this conversion experience, only then do you realize, looking back in retrospect, that that's the way you felt. When you're going through that, you can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't understand it. So I thought about this for a little while, and then I said, I suppose that there's a couple of reasons why I want to do this. The first reason is because it shows the glory of God, and that God works miracles every single day. I grew up in an environment or was raised in a religion that felt that the only time you see a miracle from God is if a statue happens to cry for no apparent reason, or a priest happens to faint every Good Friday for 40 straight years, or there's a vision of Mary that nobody can explain. And although these things I pondered greatly, I can never come up with an explanation or rationale as to why it would happen, because they're always cryptic or mystical or far away. And I couldn't understand it. But my testimony, as far as I'm concerned, happens to be, in my life anyway, what I refer to as the second greatest story ever told. Because if I couldn't tell this story, I certainly would not be spending my eternity in heaven, as Ed mentioned. Basically, what I'm going to talk about is typical, I think, of what millions of people today, hundreds of millions of people today. And as far as my testimony is concerned, I don't get up here and I don't sit here and tell you that I'm some heinous criminal that saw the light and came to know God. I'm also not going to sit here and tell you I'm a famous Christian that after coming to know God, I've done all these wonderful and tremendous things. But I think from being a very typical unbeliever and becoming a believer, I think there's great insight into that, and I think there's a great lesson into that. To see the hand of God in lives. And ladies and gentlemen, that's what it's all about. That's why we're here today. It's because God works miracles every single day in people's lives. So my hope today is that we can see, through my testimony anyway at least, the glory of God. I think you can see it here today just by looking at me. Because it certainly is a miracle that I'm standing up here talking to you today about God and about His Son, Jesus Christ. When about 5 years ago, where I would be on a Sunday morning, would be sleeping off a hangover from a hard night before, pondering what I would make myself for breakfast and how long it would take me to read the Sunday paper before I went and turned the television on and watched some kind of sporting event. So, He does change lives, and I enjoy this much more. All right, here's where it starts. I was born in New York, New York City, about 20 miles from the center of New York City. And I was raised in a Catholic family, you could call it, although they were non-practicing. As a matter of fact, my father is an atheist, still contends that to this day. Any type of entree that I make as far as spiritual things to my father, he laughs and chuckles as if it is just something that, to be laughed at. But my father, nevertheless, never went to church, so I never had an example. I never had an example of a loving, God-like father. My mother, tried as she would, took us through the rituals of getting us into Catholic education or some type of religious education up until the point of time where we could make decisions for ourselves. And then she ceased to stop going to church herself and just left us on our own, thinking that she had done her job. And there was a reason for that, and that is we were brought up with the fear of God. Not the love of God, the fear of God. There's a big, big difference. That the way to get to God was to do things. Things such as go through these rituals. Now, through my life, I believe that because I was baptized when I was a baby, that I didn't have anything to worry about. I was going to heaven because I was baptized into the Catholic Church. If I was fortunate enough to go after high school to get accepted to the University of Notre Dame, I had it made. I'd have one of the top echelons in heaven. So baptism and where you went to school played a very big part in the Catholic religion. At least for me it did anyway, and for what I was told. But I was born up on a series of ethics that had works centered around it. In other words, I had to be baptized. I had to receive confirmation. I had to go to church every Sunday, and if I did not, it was a sin. If I went to an Episcopal church or a Methodist church or a Baptist church, I was sinning. That was a sin. So because of all these rigid, strict things that I had to do in order to think I was pleasing God, I maintained a fairly straight line through at least up until the latter part of high school. And then it all kind of caught up with me. I got kind of fed up with the whole thing. I got tired of the idea. I was striving, and I knew I was failing. I wasn't getting anywhere. So I decided to take matters into my own hands. Now, growing up in the latter part of the 60s, you could probably understand what that meant. Because what was out there, much like today, the world sends these messages to people that keep going in and keep getting into your mind, sort of like subliminal perception, where today is have it your way, you deserve this, you've worked hard, you deserve a break today. And back then, it was that rebellion was promoted. Don't be like everybody else. Be different. It's your life. It's your body. You can put on your body whatever you want. You can put in your body whatever you like. The only person you're going to hurt is yourself. So don't worry about it. Say what you feel and feel what you like. In essence, be different. So I became different. I grew my hair down to my shoulders and didn't buy new clothes, just wore whatever's around until it was falling off me. And I thought that was pretty nice. I remember even looking in the mirror one time and saying, yeah. That's the way you're supposed to look if you're going to be with it. So I thought I was with it. But also being with it, a lot of other things go along with being with it, such as partying. Now, don't misconstrue the term partying where you get a 15 or 20 people in a room and you sit and have small talk and sip little drinks. A party in this regard is just any excuse where more than one person can get together and consume large quantities of beverage. Smoke large quantities of leaf and just get together and talk about nothing. And if there wasn't a party, then I would invariably end up at a bar doing the same thing there. And I went through high school this way, believe it or not, and when I got to college, it was the same thing. Nothing had changed. I did manage to eke out an education doing that. But weekends now were more than just Saturdays and Sundays. Weekends started on Thursday evenings, and they went up to Sunday nights. So you could see it was starting to impinge on your whole total life, this whole partying atmosphere. The whole total sad part about this is, I remember sitting down one time and talking to a friend of mine, and I remember saying to him, you know something, Joe? If I died right now, I'd be happy because I lived a rich and full life and I've enjoyed myself. And you may laugh at that, but just the tragedy of a statement like that, that I made. Now, it could be immaturity, and I'm sure a lot of it was immaturity. But this is all that I saw in life as a young person. This is all that most people out there today see in life. The pursuit of pleasure. The pursuit of things for themselves. The close-knit circle of friends. And the things that they can glean and get for themselves. So on it went. When I graduated from college, I graduated in 1974. And if any historians are out there, especially economic historians, that was a fairly good-sized recession. So I hit the workplace with diploma in hand, only to have every door closed in my face that I ever knocked on. And I kind of went into a little bit of a shell. couldn't find a job. I had no money. So I had to go back and work labor. Now, I don't have a problem working labor. But the people I worked with, of course, were not what you would consider godly people. And that language and that style of living started rubbing off on me more and more. And of course, as the labor jobs go, you have good times and you have bad times. So I spent about half that time in labor and the other half the time on unemployment. So things were looking fairly bleak if you look at trying to be a success in life or trying to make some things out of life. But I had an idea. And the idea was this, because I saw my friends that were on unemployment with me doing this and doing very well at it. That's go to the racetrack. Because when you're on unemployment, you go and you get a check each week, and now you have a little bit of money, and you don't work for it, but you got a lot of time. So if you want to parlay that into something else, you'd go to the racetrack and you'd put your money on horses. And foolishly enough, for me, the first time I went, I won. And it kind of got into my blood a little bit. Not the fact that I had a problem with gambling, but I thought this was a quick and easy and a dirty way out. And a good way to get some money, too. Without working. Without responsibilities. What a plan. I couldn't pull it off. Because nobody pulls that off. It doesn't work. It can't work. It's foolishness. All through this, all going through this, in the back of my mind was this little thing that said, Dave, you're hypocritical. Because even though that training was based on works that I had from a religious standpoint, I knew there was a God out there. And I knew he was trying to tell me something. But when it came down to doing something about it, I decided, I'll take my chances. Right? I was never curious enough to sit down and to seek God out, or to grope for God, to open a Bible up, or to ask somebody a question about that. That would show weakness. And now, as we get into the mid-70s, this whole thing about wearing long hair and being with it, that's out the window. Now you got to be macho. So you don't talk about God. You don't talk about weaknesses. You don't talk about your fears. But you build up these walls and you build up these shells and you also try and build up your body. So you can look like you're the pinnacle of strength or a tower of strength. But I knew that there was something there. Now, 6 years out of college, after all this stuff, I decided, well, this is enough. I think maybe what I'll try and do is just get a little bit more substance to my life. So I happened to wander into a telephone company office one day in upstate New York, and I applied for a job in the telephone company. I didn't know what I was going to do. I just knew the telephone company very rarely lays people off, and they make about $1 billion a year. That's where I wanted to be. I was tired of all this playing around, and I was tired of not having some substance behind me. And that is really where I think my conversion process starts. Because I got this job with, not with New York Telephone, but with New England Telephone in Boston. And I moved to Boston, and I began working there. And now things started picking up for me from a secular standpoint. I wasn't on unemployment anymore. Right? I now had some money. I had a good job. I had things behind me, but that's all I had. I still had this gaping black hole there. Of that question about, you know, what is all this for? I mean, what do I do when I get 65 and I draw a pension plan? Well, then what happens? Another 10, 15 years and then I die? I mean, what is it all worthwhile? I mean, life was really meaningless to me, except getting up every single day and doing the same job and coming home and doing the same things I did before I had my job, hanging out with the same people I hung out with, and then going and doing it again. Day in, day out, waiting for, as a popular beer commercial says, the weekend. Because that's what it meant. Now, if you follow business a little bit, you know about 4 years ago, this great big thing called AT&T was split up by mandate by the federal government. And there again is a big part of my conversion process. I don't purport to think that God broke up the bell system so I could get saved. But I got caught up in the backwash of this. And in 1982, I was attending a meeting in Philadelphia. I lived in Boston. And I was attending a meeting in Philadelphia to a sales meeting. All the salespeople around the country that worked for AT&T came into this meeting. I met this woman there at this meeting. And this woman was very intriguing to me from two aspects. Number one, her knowledge of what her job was, me being a neophyte, not knowing too much about what was going on anyway. And her physical prowess also. To make a long story short, I went after this girl and I started dating her. She lived in Chicago, I lived in Boston, and we met in Philadelphia. Now, unbeknownst to me, this girl that I met and I started dating, this long-distance romance, had a sister that was saved 6 years ago before when I met her. And she had a whole church praying for this girl, her sister. And I didn't know this. And they had finally gotten her into a church called River Forest Bible Chapel here in Illinois. And they got her to start coming to Bible studies. But because she was Catholic, she would never stay for the breaking the bread meeting or the 11 o'clock family hour because it was a sin. You couldn't do that in another church if you were a Catholic. So she started asking me questions about spiritual things. And if you grow up Catholic, there's 52 weeks in a year. And every week, there's the name of a Sunday. And that Sunday has the same biblical passage read on it every same Sunday of each year. So I was probably true to the Catholic Church for about 5 years, so I at least had some of these stories that I had heard five times that I tried to convince her of my knowledge of spiritual things. Not so much because I was a godly person, because I was falling in love with her. I wanted to be impressed with her. I had this pride about me that it was me, that I could win this girl over, that I had control of my life, that I was strong. Okay. What a pride. Tremendous pride. I can remember one time a friend and me were walking down the street and somebody said to us, "Son, are you saved?" And I was so proudful. I said, "What makes you think I'm not?" And when you look back and you hear a statement like that, I mean, that speaks volumes of what that answer said. So, here we go. I start dating this woman, who happens to be my wife, by the way. His name is Barbara. And she's asking me these questions. She has an office out in Philadelphia, so she commutes rather regularly between Chicago and Philadelphia. It turns out the guy that she works with in Philadelphia is a Catholic who is a born-again Catholic, and he moonlights on the side giving Bible studies. And my wife caught him putting an easel and some chalk in his trunk one day and said, "What are you doing, Ron? Are you moonlighting?" He says, "Well, no, I teach a Bible study." And she said, "Oh." She says, "Do you know what being saved means?" And he went on to talk to her. And he invited her out to this prayer meeting. And she consented to go. And she went to this prayer meeting. At this prayer meeting, there's all sorts of speaking in tongues and things going on because they were Pentecostal in nature. And my wife heard something that was referred to as a sinner's prayer, which basically is the gospel. And that night, after 6 years of people praying for her, she came to her knees and accepted the Lord as her Savior. And what's the first thing she did? She went back to her hotel room. She called me up. And she starts telling me that she's born again and she's saved. And, you know, I'm on the phone. That's enough for me. That's too much. So I'm very perplexed right now. I'm not sure what's going on. That weekend, the bell system broke up. The weekend I got that phone call. I had to move my office. And I moved my office from Boston to a place north of Boston, a place called Lexington, Massachusetts. I'd never heard of it before. I'd never been there before. First day that I'm in this office, I know nobody, and I'm unpacking my bags, putting them into my cube, and I get up and I start heading for the men's room. And there's a guy sitting there, just as I'm about to go out the door, and he's got a Good News Bible on his desk. Now, I'd never saw this guy. And because of what happened to this girl that I was dating and all the conversations we had, my curiosity was piqued. So I asked this guy, I said, "Do you read that thing?" And he said, "Yeah, sit down." So I sat down, and I don't know how many people are out there in sales, but when you're in sales and the phone rings at your desk, you pick it up because you spend a lot of time trying to get clients to call you to make your job easier. Well, this man started talking to me about the Bible, and his phone rang four times. He never made a move for it. And that impressed me so much because what we were talking about was so much more important in his mind than whoever was on that other end of that phone call. Now, you're a customer service person, you don't want to hear that, probably. But it did the trick for me. He gave me a book, and he says, the best thing I can do is tell you to go home and read this book. So I read this book, and it was a book by an author by the name of Hal Lindsey, and it was called The Liberation of the Planet Earth. And I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. I went back to my cube, and I started reading it. I went home that night, and I read it, and there on page 119 was a picture of this chasm here, a cliff here with my pride and my sin and my lifestyle on this side of the cliff, and God's righteousness over here, right? And bridging that chasm was the cross. Maybe some of you have seen it. Now, I know for me, I talk to people about their testimonies. And sometimes they say to me, well, I think I was 4, I was 5 when I got saved. I'm not really certain. For me, it was like that. It was the exact same thing as if a plate to the scales had fallen off my eyes for Paul. And I remember I blurted out, so that's it. Now I know why he died. He died for me. Because I'm a worm and I'm a bum. And look at the things I've been doing. I've been doing it for me. It's my life. It's his life. And he stole it back. He stole it back. He took it back from me. He gave it to me and I took it away from him. And he died for me. That was 1 week after this girl that I had met 6 months before had gotten saved. She got saved in Philadelphia at a Pentecostal Catholic meeting, which is, some people may say, ironic. I got saved reading out of a book, laying in bed in my apartment. Of course, our relationship changed after that, drastically. So, that's how I stand up here today to talk to you, okay? Also found out that when I moved my office to this place called Lexington, Massachusetts, there happened to be a Bible chapel right down the street that I had never seen before, I never knew before. And to me, this whole Christian thing was like this underground culture that I'd never heard of before. People in Chicago called people in Lexington, Massachusetts and told me to call me at my office to get me to come to church on Sunday morning. Now, I remember the first day I walked into a place just like this. I walked in, and I looked around, and I said to the elder, I said, where's the cross? Well, what kind of church is this? There's no cross here. And the guy just stopped me in his tracks. He said, Jesus isn't on the cross anymore. He's alive. So, that's how I got into the fold, as it was said. So what's the point of this story? Is that it? It's 12 o'clock. Do I stop the story there and I say it's a nice story, praise God, let's all go home? No, because the story doesn't end there. It can't end there for anybody, whether you're 2 years old or whether you're 102 years old. Okay? What's the first thing you had to do? And I'm not sure I did it well, but the first thing I realized about myself is I had two things. I had discernment about what is right and what is wrong and what's good for me. And I also had an insatiable thirst to learn more about this book right here, about the Bible. And I started reading it. And I thought about Paul after reading the book of Acts. What did Paul do when he got saved? Okay? He went away for 3 years. And he learned about his Savior, about God. How many of us put that much effort after our conversion experience? How many of us put that much effort today to keep learning more about what is in here? You know, when you go out today and you leave here, one of the things I just thought of as I was walking around here preparing for this is that it's springtime. And what do you see in spring? You see new life. Now, new life isn't there just like my new life when I became a Christian through this testimony, didn't just sit there as new life. It did things. It had to do things. What did it do? It sought to grow. Just like a plant or a tree in this new life in spring, it seeks to grow. It seeks moisture. It seeks the dirt. It seeks nourishment to feed itself so it can grow. We have to do the same thing as Christians. Continually. Not just in springtime. Every season. Okay? You walk by some plants, they have a nice aroma about them, a bouquet. Right? There's a reason for that. Because their main job, their main function, is to pollinate. We need to do the same thing. Pollinate. Talk about the hope that is in us. Talk about our testimony. Talk about our conversion. Okay? Secondly, everything we do, must be done as to the Lord, or unto the Lord. Our jobs, driving in our car, going into a restaurant, anything, do it as unto the Lord. You know, I think I've said this story once before, but it's the guy that in a restaurant tells the waitress that this meal is awful, take it back, it's garbage, I won't eat it. Or it's the guy that cuts off that person in front of them and because they're going too slow on the road. Well, what happens if you got a flat tire in front of that guy that you just cut off? And he pulls over to help you. Could you witness to him? Could you witness to that waitress that you just threw the food back in their face? We need to be reminded of these things often, always, by each other. And lastly, I'd leave this. It's just go out and do it. Okay? We can sit here and we can read this all the time. We've got to do something. We've got to do things. We've got to reach out. We've got to help people. We've got to tell people about Jesus Christ and what he offers up. It's the only way. Look at the news. Look at the newspapers. There is no other solution. It's Christ. It's the only way. Now look at my salvation, my testimony. Life was meaningless to me. What does God give? What does Christ give? He gives meaning to life. Because now I know why I'm here. I'm here to glorify him. I don't glorify him every second of the day. In fact, there are many days, that I don't glorify him at all. But boy, I know I'm supposed to. And I know I've got to try. And I've got to try and do better. The other thing is, you've got to bring others to know this. Bring others to know God. And lastly, you are somebody when you know Jesus Christ. Because he took it upon himself to go die for you. Just as James says, show me your works and I'll show you your faith. Okay? I'd leave you with this. If there's anyone here today that can have some type of semblance of relation to this testimony that I gave, turn with me to 1 Peter, the book of 1 Peter. And let me just read one verse to you. First Peter chapter 4. And there's 2 points I want to bring out here. If you're thinking about God, if you're thinking about your meaning in your life, if you're thinking about what you've done, let me read this to you. Chapter 4 of 1 Peter, let me start from verse 3. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, pursuing a course of sensuality, lusts, drunkenness, carousals, drinking parties, abominable idolatries. And in all this, they are surprised you do not run with them into the same excess of dissipation, and they malign you. 2 points. Number one, what you've done in your life as far as being away from God, it's enough. You've enjoyed it enough. It's time to get serious. It's time to follow the path that God has set out for you. Number two, just as Paul said after his conversion that he bears the wounds and the stripes for his conversion of Jesus Christ, we at least ourselves need to bear some calluses. It doesn't have to be a wound or a stripe. Just get some calluses out there. And right here in verse 4, it says, they're surprised. My friends that I used to hang around with, they don't want me as a friend anymore. They don't want any part of me. My family that saw me do all these things, they think I'm the biggest hypocrite out there. Because now I'm talking about Jesus and being saved and being righteous. There's a price to pay. So I would say 2 things. Number one, if you can relate to this testimony,
look at this verse and understand that what you have accomplished so far, that's enough. Stop. Give your life to the Lord. Let Him save you, and He'll be forgiven. We had our gentleman friend from New York here today say at the breaking of the bread, the slate has been wiped clean. It's as far away as east is from west. It'll be remembered no more. Lastly, those that have already made that decision and have indulged me with this message, I would say, go pollinate and go do it. I'm about 5 minutes late, but what I would really like to do, if you would bear with me, is we sing one song together. That's song number 203 in the Brown Hymn. And it truly is an amazing love when you consider that God has died for you. Thank you.